This Saturday night, the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra takes the stage for a concert called Leonard Bernstein's 100th. And the guest conductor is the marvelously talented Bulgarian-born, Juilliard-trained Stylian Kirov. So nice to have you in the studio today.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
You are one of a handful of top contenders for the position of music director with the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, and it's been a pleasure to meet a few of them over the season and see such an array of dedication and fierce commitment to music making. You all have that in common. But today's the day to get to know Stylian. So I understand that you already have a lot of experience conducting orchestras of regions about our size in New Jersey and...
Yes, that's true. Well, I have three orchestras right now in New Jersey, in Illinois, and in California, in Bakersfield. So, yes, it has been busy in the past few seasons, but I feel as an artist today, that's really what you need to be doing and look for opportunities to make difference, first of all, with your music making and make people's life happier with music and more meaningful with music. And I just feel very lucky that I have the chance to do this in three different communities. I'm extremely excited about being considered for the position here. It's my second time coming to Kalamazoo. I was here last year. And I just love the city. Now I even already know the wonderful places in the city to have coffee, to have lunch and dinner. So it really feels at home. And we had our first rehearsal with the orchestra yesterday night. And it's a really wonderful environment to make music.
What was it about music that it became your life? Did you have a musical family? Was there a Brahms symphony on the radio that turned your ear?
Yes, sort of. I have musical family, although my parents are not musicians. They just surrounded me with music since probably day one. I had the chance to be exposed to a lot of different types of music. I listened to a lot of classical music. But also, you know, just by saying musical family, you don't have to be a musician to have music in your life. And we would always sing songs together. I will play on the piano. My mom used to play the piano a little bit just for fun. My dad is singing sometimes. I think he has a very good voice, actually. He's of course just having fun with it. He's not not a professional
singer.
Yeah. But we my sister loves music as well. So we really celebrated with music in our lives, and I feel that was very important as I was forming as a human being, and that's who I want to be. Now later in life, I decided that as I was playing piano more and more and more, I really thought that's what I want to do in my life. So I entered a special musical school in Bulgaria that was basically concentrated on music. It's like a high school for musicians. So it was 5 years. And at this time actually was the time when I really started looking into conducting a little bit more. So I played the piano. I also played the oboe. And I had wonderful teachers who gave me the opportunity actually to try what conducting is. And I conducted a little bit of the school orchestra, a little bit of the chorus in the school. And I just fell in love with it simply because, well, first of all, because of the colors of the human voice and the instruments, the different instruments of the orchestra. And also because of the fact that we are building something together with peer musicians. And this was the time probably where I thought, well, that's really what I would love to do. And now maybe, I don't know, maybe 20 years later now, I really feel very lucky to be doing what I'm doing, because when your job is your hobby, you don't have to work a day in your life. Well, technically speaking, you still, you know. But also the other part of the conducting profession that I really like is the complexity of it. You know, the music is obviously the main part, but you also have to communicate with a lot of people. You have to know a little bit about, well, a lot about politics, diplomacy. Also these days, as to be effective leader, you have to be very involved in the fundraising and different activities of the orchestra, education as well. So it's a very complex job that I find extremely rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Those are all parts of the music director job that seem to have changed over time, but you're describing it as it is today. You're a leader and a figurehead and someone who needs to be the person who reaches out to groups in the community says the symphony is a fun place to be.
Right. And it's also, you're also the person to form these relationships. And I feel that a part of presenting what we are doing, the role of the music director is also to be interested in the community. And not only that, but being part of the community. And because every community is different, you have to feel the spirit of every city in order for you to, and the administration of the orchestra and the whole team and the family of the orchestra, to create something that speaks to this community.
Mm-hmm. And I know it is possible for conductors to be that person in more than one place. Mm-hmm. Our Battle Creek Symphony conductor, Ann Harrigan, is the Battle Creek Symphony conductor and the Billings, Montana Symphony conductor. Right. So this is a fairly common thing these days, too.
It really is. And of course, you have to be wise about it, but every orchestra you have, you should consider every orchestra you have as your kid. And no one is more important than another, and they're all top priority. And you cannot show up only for birthdays. You have to be there throughout the whole process of the growth of the organization. So I think that's another exciting aspect of it.
And I agree that it is magic when 70 or 80 people are so unified in accomplishing one thing. Yeah. And you don't get to see that very often in life.
Yeah, it's a magical moment, really. And sometimes, it's very interesting. It's very often a matter of energy that happens. Obviously, we all rehearse, but when we come to the concert, this is the time when I cannot speak anymore. But still, we hopefully build this energy level where we feel each other in a way that we can make the music more and more alive and bring excitement to the audience.
Let's talk about Leonard Bernstein's energy. He had a lot of it.
He really did. And with Leonard Bernstein, I think more is more. That was probably his leading theme, but probably the greatest American artist, period. Yeah. And I feel that this was, it was very, very new to the American classical music scene, because he was the first major American to hold major positions as the music director of the New York Philharmonic. He also emerged as a conductor and as a composer as well. And I feel that he really shaped the American culture in a very significant way with his appearance. As you all know, speaking purely about the music, I feel that his music is extremely honest and it's very diverse. And although we are performing works by the same composer, they're all very different in a way. You have all these different aspects of Lenny's personality in them. He was charming and he was fun, but he was also kind of a deep, almost deep philosophic thinking about everything. He was very inspired by theater. He had all these different inspirations. He was extremely knowledgeable man. He was kind of crazy sometimes and maybe a little bit aggressive. But he was this inspiring figure. And his music is all he was.
For someone with an encyclopedic knowledge of music, he could also connect with audiences, his young people's concerts.
Absolutely.
He was able to distill it down and make it sound so vital and so important when he's talking to young people.
And this continues today. I mean, he really shaped the way American classical music education is headed now, you know, so that he created this path with this with the young people's concerts, and every orchestra in America does this these days, and I think these are extremely meaningful. And he was just this huge inspiration. He still is, actually. I think he still lives through his music, through his young people's concert videos. And I watch this sometimes because I think they're not only extremely enjoyable, but I keep learning from him. Even 100 years, now that we are celebrating 100 years of him, you know, that's, I'm sure it will be for another at least 200-300 years, if not forever.
My guest is conductor Stylian Kirov, who will lead the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra Saturday night in a concert starting at 8 o'clock, and will also give a pre-concert talk at 7 p.m. at Miller Auditorium. Two guest artists are featured on the program, and we will meet both of them tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour on WMUK, Anne Akiko Myers and Janae Bridges. And right now, you can pledge support to your public radio station by going to WMUK.org. While we listen to the opening piece on the program, this is the overture to Candide, and I'll have Mr. Kirov's thoughts on the overture after we listen.
Excellent.
On record there, that was the Los Angeles Philharmonic with Leonard Bernstein conducting. And my guest here today is another conductor, Stylian Kirov, who will lead the KSO on Saturday. And tickets are available right now through the KalamazooSymphony.com website. So it's one of the best overtures out there,
absolutely.
I think.
Oh, I love it.
And it brings together themes from, is it an operetta?
Yes. It was still considered more of a kind of a Broadway
music
theater piece.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when it was premiered, it didn't by Broadway standards, it had only I think like 74 or 5 performances, which is considered as not a success. But by opera standards, that's actually a huge success, you know. so it's a very interesting way how it's looked at. Bernstein had this huge affiliation with theater in general and admiration for theater. It started from his very early steps in music, we can say, and he would put different pieces together that he will accompany from the piano, and he had this just love for voices in theater. So he was very inspired by obviously Voltaire's Candide, and he created this sort of operetta opera musical thing. And Candide it's extremely interesting because it's Bernstein's other pieces, it's all Bernstein, you know, this has this deep feeling, but there are all these jokes and there is this deep meaningful part of it, but I feel that nowadays probably Candide is the most known for its overture. And it's performed and the overture actually includes many of the different themes of the whole piece itself.
Right. So if you have an opportunity to see a production of Candide,
right,
you'll be kind of surprised at times when the soprano is singing the song from the overture.
And, exactly. Yeah. And I sometimes, you know, as I sometimes when I listen even to the overture, when we listen, as we listened it now, I like to hum the text, you know, of some of the songs, because they're very vividly present in the material, in the overture, in the symphonic material. But the overture itself, it's very exciting. I can say technically challenging, but also, you know, it has this feeling of going forward in the whole piece, you know, especially the statement in the beginning with this fanfare introduction. So I'm always excited when we perform it. It's a piece of a lot of exciting rhythms as well, I can say, because for example, when it starts, you hear the bass line that goes pop, 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 you know, all this, but then it shifts over the bar. So that's something that I pretty much suspect Bernstein, I don't want to say steal, but took from Stravinsky as well. That, as you know, if you notice, sometimes there are no bar lines in Stravinsky, you know, there is this one motif that keeps repeating, and he doesn't care if it's on the second beat or on the third beat, and sometimes you find it on every single part of the bar. So compositionally, I feel sometimes you see this in Bernstein a lot. And as well as in his Serenade, as well as even in West Side Story, which was his other musical theater piece that was a tremendous success and really changed the face of musical theater in the world, I would say.
I know you are a symphonic conductor, but have you ever conducted West Side Story as a...
It's one of my dreams to do the whole musical. West Side Story, as well as Porgy and Bess, actually. That's my other big... that's another big piece in my bucket list, but it's really, I feel that's a great way to open the concert with this overture. It's a great way to get in the spirit of Bernstein, since even in these 4 minutes you hear Bernstein in its most pure, honest writing.
There are two more pieces that follow Candide that I would say most audiences don't get a chance to hear very often. Mm-hmm. They're important works in his development, and coming up, we'll be talking about his very first symphony, which he wrote just out of Harvard, I think, just out of graduation from Harvard. But now's the time we turn to this Serenade after Plato's Symposium. Mm-hmm. Bernstein did a lot of reading, I'm understanding.
He pretty much did. And this was very, very much inspired of these conversations about love at this symposium. I think it's probably one of his most challenging pieces, but also one of the most rewarding ones. It's a piece that includes, it's basically what's happening in the symposium is that all these Greek philosophers gather together and they start talking about the topic of love. And so the very beginning, the first movement, is the discussion about the duality of love. What it is to love and to be loved, you know. Then the second movement, Aristophan comes in, and usually sometimes he's regarded as a kind of a clown and very humorous character in the ancient Greek literature. But in this case, he is more of a storyteller gives this fairy image of love, fairy tale image of love. Let's put it this way. So it really sounds like a lullaby if you think about it. The third movement is actually the doctor's view on love, and he described the harmonious bodily functions, and it's kind of a fun, quick, very straightforward movement. And then there is this very deep conversation about the demonic side of love as well.
Wouldn't want to leave that out.
Yeah, no, you couldn't. Yeah, and I think it's a very, very interesting aspect. But this is actually and it's total Bernstein in his purest. This deep demonic conversation is interrupted by a drunken philosopher who comes with his friends, and the whole symposium ends with a, you know, with a big party and celebrating love. And this final section of the piece is also extremely brilliantly written, extremely challenging, with a lot of, I think, this drunken element that he's trying to recreate also is with the ambiguity of the rhythms, because sometimes things appear where you almost don't think they would. And I feel it's an extremely inspiring inspiring piece. And also, of course, having Anna Kiko Myers performing it with us, that it couldn't be better. I'm extremely inspired and excited about this.
She is a terrific, such an experienced soloist and a wonderful recording artist. I can't wait to talk to her tomorrow on the program here. And you can support this program right now with a pledge to WMUK.org. Shall we jump into the serenade or start at the beginning? And what are your thoughts on why it's called serenade?
Well, I think it's serenade because of the theme of love to begin with. So I think that's the main reason. Probably also because of the conversational kind of expressive talk about it. You know, serenade sometimes is when you tell somebody that you love them, or, you know, there's, if we go back to the meaning of the word, you think of all the troubadours and knights who have the guitar under the window, you know. So I think it's talking about love. And that's probably the main reason. That this is a guess, but I think it's pretty much what he had in mind.
Did Leonard Bernstein say anything about why there's a solo violin and what the solo violin represents?
He didn't really say that. I think it's the voice of the philosopher who speaks at the moment, but also I think it's also love itself that kind of maybe plays around and creates the connection between people, you know. So it's probably both.
Let's hear how this serenade begins.
Okay, wonderful.
The first movement of the Serenade for Violin and Orchestra by Leonard Bernstein after Plato's Symposium. Mm-hmm. And as my guest Stylian Kirov explained, Bernstein was literally taking scenes from a philosophical argument and about love that shows the many faces of love.
Absolutely. It's a really, really wonderful piece of music. Also, I think very interesting orchestration-wise. It's actually for a smaller ensemble with huge percussion section and strings and percussion. Actually, there are no winds, so it's very peculiar orchestration as well. This also makes it very, very interesting and unusual in a way.
I love the way that, By how it starts, you sure can't tell where it's going to end up. Even though I think there are themes you hear again and again, they're transformed so well and such different character comes through.
Oh no, it's absolutely brilliant piece of music, and I'm, as I said, having Anna Kiko Myers perform it, which she actually really, it's one of the pieces that I think she performs quite often as well. So she really has taken this serenade journey quite often, and it's very, very inspiring to be working with her.
Do you study scores at the piano, which is your main instrument, or do you go off and hear them just in your head as you look at the score?
It really depends. If I'm to discover a score for the first time, piano is extremely, extremely helpful. Now, with pieces that I have done already, I tend to be able to hear the score in my head. But also, I like still playing on the piano, because you have to touch the music a little bit, as I like to say. You know, you just feel the harmonies, you feel the vibrations of the chords, you feel all this. Even if you not necessarily play it really in tempo in a concert version, you know, I think just going through the score with an instrument allows you to indulge deeper in the music. And that's almost always a must for me. Sometimes actually, like for example today, I have done this program, the pieces in this program, not the whole program together itself, but I have done it in the past. But today I'm trying to find actually some time to sit on the piano and touch the music again. Hmm. You know, so it's always a good thing to do for a conductor.
Yes, yeah, so you appreciate what each individual in the orchestra is doing on their own, which is studying their part and performing, you know, getting their instrument ready and going. Is there any instrument or section in the orchestra that is the least understandable to you as a player?
I couldn't,
had to work hardest to really grasp the technique of their.
Well, it really depends on the orchestra. Every orchestra is different, and I think we get to know each other almost after 2 to 5 minutes. First of all, I'm like an open book to them, because they have a lot of experience, and from my perspective, I can feel a little bit better where I'm needed more and where I can let go a little bit more, you know. So it's an interesting process. It's a very good question. I feel that every orchestra is slightly different, so you as a conductor, you have to be able to feel that and assess that. I think now, after years of working with many wonderful musicians, I'm able to do this. It's almost automatic, you know. It's like a reflex where, okay, I have to be helpful there, or I'm not needed there, or I shouldn't bother this section of the orchestra there. And that's another big part of our job, is to know when you can be helpful and when you can help unify the team, and where you actually can let the musicians make music and be free. I think we also built this trust and this communication aspect during the rehearsal process.
And here's a kind of more basic, stupid question. Of all the instruments in the orchestra, which would be your least favorite to have to learn yourself?
To have to learn myself, I don't know about favorite, but I would be horrified if I had to play the French horn. simply because it's a wonderful, amazing instrument, but it's so complex, I feel. And of course, this doesn't mean that the others aren't, but I feel that there's the instrument I would be just scared to be in their shoes, you know?
Great. Well, why don't we turn now to the Jeremiah Symphony?
Yes, wonderful.
Like another Bernstein work, and from his earlier career.
Yes. He completed it. Actually, he wrote it for a competition, for a composing competition that was organized by the Kusevitsky Foundation. It's funny because I think he was completing his studies in Harvard, but he might have been already in Curtis at this time. And Kusevitsky was his mentor. So he was very inspired to submit his score, and the deadline, I think, was 31st of December. And he had somebody delivered it to his door his personal house, you know, to his home.
He made the deadline only with that much time.
Exactly, exactly. On the 31st of December, you know, somebody knocked on the door. But it's a piece that actually it's a beginning of a journey for Bernstein, if you think of it, because it's about religion. It's a very religious piece. But this piece, all his symphonies are actually unified in a way under this journey. So first, the first symphony, Jeremiah, is about the destruction of religion, and this is symbolized by the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Now, when this journey begins, this piece ends up with a little bit of I want to say a little bit of a positive acceptance and hope, but also in the same time, it's in the second symphony when he begins again the search to find the spirituality of humans, and then in the third one, he finds it, but it's also he came to the conclusion that that this has to go with pain as well. So pain, and this also actually goes back to the ancient Greece and the philosophy that knowledge is pain, and knowledge and pain, they go together. It's a very serious topic, if you think about it. The piece itself, I always see two characters in a way. It's based on the Jewish religion themes of the Bible of Sabbath as well. There is a lot of this thematic material that is used, probably not some of it, not so much in a direct way, but you still feel some intervals and harmonies that are definitely there. There are two main characters in my mind, and one is the praying element, because the themes are just very much related to prayer, but also the other element is the element of warning and upcoming danger in a way, distraction. But it's also when we were working yesterday with the orchestra, actually I always feel it's not an aggressive, at least in the first movement, it's not an aggressive writing. It's writing of maybe desperation, maybe so this wise statement of warning, the prophecy, that's how the first movement is called. But also we come to the second movement, where you have this dance that is also very, very, with a lot of ambiguous changing rhythms. It's a relationship maybe with certain profane spirituality. And that's this is probably the most challenging movement of the piece. The third movement involves the singing voice. Actually, I don't know if there is some relationship with Beethoven, but maybe not. But we have a wonderful mezzo soprano, actually, Jeanette de Bridge, who is coming to join us for this program as well. So we have two wonderful soloists, and this last movement ends up with certain idea of peace that can be achieved. It's very spiritual movement, really, and it's extremely passionate, and this is where we see Bernstein is his very, very serious work and very serious thematic exposure and context, of course.
Did he win this competition?
Funny enough, no, he didn't win the competition. Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah, he probably was thinking he would, because they were very close to Koussevitzky, with Koussevitzky. Koussevitzky was a father figure for him. And they were together all throughout his development, and, you know, in Tanglewood, of course. And Leonard Bernstein really looked up to him as his maybe musical, artistic father.
It's wonderful. It's interesting that Bernstein's first symphony includes a vocal part. That's unusual. And most young composers would probably try to hit the standard.
Right. Sort of. Well, or as I said, you know, maybe he had some, I cannot say that that's completely true, but as you know, Beethoven was the first one who broke this instrumental cage, let's say this way, and included voices in his Ninth Symphony with the chorus and of course the four soloists who sing. So Beethoven introduced the idea that sometimes, especially with the recit in the Ninth Symphony, that sometimes music can say a lot, but there are things that music cannot say, and you actually need the text. So it is possible that Bernstein also used this philosophy when he was presenting this very, very first symphony of his.
Will Jenay Bridges sing in English or in Hebrew?
Oh, it's in Hebrew, I'm sure. Hebrew. Yeah, I haven't talked to her, but I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Jeremiah was a prophet who warned of the destruction of Babylon, I think.
And correct.
So that was part of the prophecy and warning that you said was you can experience in the piece.
Exactly.
Which movement should we excerpt here? We can't hear the whole thing. It only takes about 24 minutes, though, to...
Correct.
To play.
I would go for the second.
Second
is always, I think it's a very special movement.
Well, here we have Mr. Bernstein himself and the Israel Philharmonic.
Oh, wonderful.